Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. Senator Betzold is our program for the day. And Senator Betzold, it's my understanding that it's okay with you if we start with Senate File 2390. Is that?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And if nothing else, I do know how to
draw folks in the audience. Yes, you do.
Yes.
And so I don't know if this one will move quickly or not, but I think it's been going on for a couple of years, the conversation about this. This is your first session carrying the bill, I think. So I'll let you proceed.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you very much. Let me give you just a quick background of Senate File 2390. In recent years, of course, with the computer age, and there's more and more opportunities for identity theft, and there's been misuse of a lot of personal information, including the Social Security number. And actually, Senator Steve Kelly carried some legislation a number of years ago to kind of put limits on the improper use of Social Security number, including transferring it, collecting, selling the data, and so forth. And we set an effective date out there so that various organizations and groups would have time to get in compliance with the new law, and that was going to be July 1st of 2007.
Right.
Last year, an issue came to our attention of a serious problem in this area, and that's the fact that the organizations that provide consumer credit reports use Social Security numbers as part of their consumer credit reports, and they interpreted our law as prohibiting them from issuing any more credit reports to Minnesota consumers after the effective date when we were going to limit the use of Social Security numbers. I don't think that that's how I read that section of the statute. I think most people did not, but that's immaterial because as long as they were reading it that way and if they were saying that they were not going to issue any more credit reports past July 1st of 07, something had to be done. Now, there was legislation introduced last year to deal with the issue. The Senate bill did not move at all. In the House, however, they spent considerable amount of time not only on that issue, but a lot of other related issues. What ultimately happened was we went to the Data Practices Conference Committee where the House had all their language, and they had to negotiate with a number of stakeholders. They had put together a lot of information, and they had quite a comprehensive package where the Senate absolutely had nothing in response because we hadn't even looked at the issue. So as a short-term fix, what we did last year was simply extend the effective date instead of July 1st of 07 to July 1st of 08. So that bought us a year. And I foolishly then said that I would work on this for the next year, and everybody took me up on it. And that's why I'm here today. The stakeholders have had a number of months to work on this issue. They've come forward. The bill that I introduced as 2390 is identical word for word to what the House had passed last year. I said that at least that'll be the starting point. We're not bound by that, but at least we'll introduce it exactly as the House passed it. It'll make it maybe easier in their body, but we obviously have to go through our process here.
Senator Betzold,
yes.
Excuse me, did the full House, the House floor pass?
What you introduced was ultimately passed through a number of committees and ultimately adopted in the Data Practices Report last year.
And I don't know if you know that the Senate author chose not to have it heard. We were willing to. So
understand.
Thank you.
It didn't move in the Senate. And I was not the Senate author.
Right, right.
However, since I promised we'd introduce the bill exactly as the House wanted it from last year, but there have been numerous discussions and negotiations going on, and in the spirit of trying to address that which we need to address and the other things we have to address, we've pared everything back to what is before you as the A1 amendment, and it's been, I believe, made available to all the interested parties prior to this hearing. So, Madam Chair, if someone would move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that I would like to proceed.
I think Senator Marty would do that. Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment here in the Senate. And let the record show we do have a quorum. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So it's a delete everything, so
yes,
now we
is,
have
Madam
that.
Chair.
The A1 amendment before us.
Disregard the bill as it was introduced. This is what we are operating off of right now. And it basically just amends a few parts of current law And as I say, it's my understanding that almost everybody, if not everybody, who has had an interest in this seems to be in agreement or concurrence with what is before you right now. On page 1, lines 28 to 30, is just use of the Social Security number identifier. It says that a person may not do any of the following. That's assign the use of Social Security number. Now it says, added the language, except in conjunction with an employee or member retirement or benefit plan. This is just something that life insurance companies feel that they have to have because they do use Social Security numbers as part of employee or member retirement plans as a primary indicator. The big issue, the one that actually I talked about a minute ago about the credit companies not being able to sell or transfer Social Security numbers, that is what is dealt with in the rest of page 1. And the language in here says it does not prohibit the transfer or disclosure of an individual Social Security number to a third party if it has no independent economic value to the seller or is incidental to a larger transaction. Now, since this amendment was drafted, it's been discussed that the next clause actually creates a big loophole because it says, or if the Social Security number is initially collected for the purpose of identifying an individual. A reading of that second clause could mean that once somebody has initially collected Social Security number for identifying it, you can then sell it and transfer and do everything you want with it. So that's probably not our intent. So what we think we would prefer to do on page 1, line 34, is after the semicolon, the word or, change that to an and. So it would be conjunctive. That is, the whole part would have to be met in order to allow the use of the Social Security numbers obtained in the course of business. So we would need that amendment to the A1 amendment basically to really clarify what the intent is here. So
Senator Marty will offer that amendment that on page 1, line 34, after the word transaction, delete the semicolon.
The semicolon stays. Yeah.
You strike or.
Insert and.
And insert and. I have a Senator Marty moves that. I have a question about that. It means that both of those pieces have to be true. Does that create a problem? I guess maybe I can ask if anybody else.
I think there's certainly individuals who may. It's my understanding that that's the case.
It's but not
if
a problem.
Wants to talk about that, this is the opportunity to do so.
Takes me back to my first question in torts class as to whether or not elements of this particular tort were conjunctive or disjunctive, and my brain froze.
Well, so, the point is right here, they are disjunctive, one or
right.
the other.
Right.
And the, frankly, the second part is a huge loophole that we don't intend. So by combining the two with the and, then they both have to go together.
Does everyone understand this amendment? Any questions from the committee? Does anybody out there that wants to speak just to this amendment? I think so. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And then, so, Madam Chair, on page 2, this is just some more cleanup language. It refers to, again, going back to, person may not do any of the following, and that's, it says here, a person, not a government entity, may restrict access. It holds only employees. Well, unfortunately, there's payroll services and other subcontractors that still need access to that, even though they're not directly employees. They would still be required under federal law to maintain the confidentiality of the data that they receive, but you do have the agent and subcontractor situation where they have to have the access that the employer has. So this just cleans up that particular part of it. And then, as you can see, everything that we're talking about here would have an effective date of July 1st of 2008, which is currently the effective date for all the changes in the Social Security use. The last part in Section 2 is simply cleanup language because nowhere do we require, the state or federal law require that the Social Security numbers be used. We don't require anything like that. We authorize and permit it. We don't require it. So this is just a more cleanup language that's in Section 2. So, Madam Chair, that is the bill as amended. I know there's many people here who have an interest in it, and I'll stand for any questions.
Senator Betzold, maybe you benefit by not having been involved in the discussion all last year, but that was very clear and concise. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. Senator Gerlach, did you have a question?
No.
Have some people. Okay. Mr. Steve Johnson and John Appitz, you might come up and share your perspective on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Steve Johnson representing the Minnesota Bankers Association and also representing today the Fair Information Practices Coalition, which is a group of businesses that have come together in Minnesota over the last couple of years to look at how information is shared and strike a balance between businesses and consumers in sharing of information. And we want to thank Senator Betzold for his leadership and willingness to tackle this important issue. By the way, I think there's a list of FIPIC members at
Mr.
your
Johnson,
table.
Mr. Johnson, there is. Members, the list of the coalition that Mr. Johnson refers to is here. So it was a large group.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I had a very long prepared statement. I'm going to set it aside and just say that we appreciate the amendment that Senator Betzold has brought forth. We are concerned about the sharing or sale of Social Security numbers and the impact on our businesses, both specifically at banks and as businesses in general. Banks specifically, just for a moment, we do need to positively identify people when they open an account. Do federal law, USA Patriot Act, state law requires this at opening. So the Social Security number is a unique identifier where we can tell, for example, that the Steve Johnson that's sitting at the opening the account with us is indeed the Steve Johnson he purports to be. So so we were concerned with the interpretation from the credit reporting agencies that they would not be able to share credit reports and actually other business transactions that could occur in the marketplace. So this, in summary, we think this amendment will do it for us, that we'll be able to conduct business as normal in the marketplace. And again, we thank Senator Betzold for his leadership, and I'll stand for any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you. Mr. Appitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer. I'm representing the Consumer Data Information Association. And I'd like to be brief and simply say ditto, but I'm going to just add a little more elaboration to that. Just so you know, the Consumer Data Information Association is a nationwide organization that represents hundreds of companies that deal with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And we've raised the concern about what the law that was passed a couple of years ago could potentially do in terms of commerce here in the state and making available credit reports to banks, et cetera, to the FIPIC group that you're looking at there, Fair Information Practices Coalition. That all said, we raised that concern. FIPIC took it very seriously. And again, Senator Betzold has given generously of his time to go through this endeavor. And our challenge, FIPIC and CDIA, was to accommodate the spirit of the law that was passed, at the same time be able to accommodate commerce here in the state of Minnesota. I think the language that you have before you, Madam Chair, and from the author, does that trick. We have a little reservation about the last change that was made, the and/or, but we're vetting that amongst ourselves. And we commend the author and the committee to going forward with the change that you've made. So I just as soon leave it at that. And again, commend and thank the author and thank you all for your time in doing this.
Are there any questions for these gentlemen?
Could I just say as well,
yes,
Murray Johnston with Experian and John Barton are here as well from Choice Point. If there's any real detailed questions that you want to get into. But it looks like you got another issue that might come to the table and raise a couple questions.
No, they're all
so
here
we
for
just
you.
As soon get out of here with all these uniformed officers sitting here. I just as soon leave as soon as possible. Thank you.
I feel especially safe actually having them here. So
good for you.
Okay. Thank you. That's fine. I know Mr. Neumeister would like to speak. Welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. To paraphrase a great movie with Richard Burton, I'm in from a cold. Secondly, I'm sorry. I've always wanted to join the Fair Information Privacy Group that they call themselves, but jokingly, when I've always asked their lobbyists, they basically say, well, are you a business, blah, 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 and I say, no, I'm not. I just come from a different perspective of what fair information is and privacy is. Senator Betzold has done a great job, and finally, where we're going to have a law become effective after it's been 3 years on the book. You've got to remember where this bill came from. The bill came from with a lot of political stuff from Pawlenty, stuff from Attorney General Hatch at that time, and a couple other things thrown in to where we had one of the top bills for the protection of Social Security numbers in the state to take effect 3 years in 2007. And what happened between that time, folks started to get antsy, particularly in the business community. And then again last year, it came back. But also last year's bill, there were some things added in, some things amended, and it was more of a worse kind of thing. So I say thank you, Senator Betzold, for taking a hard one to do and to do something with it, at least to get the law in the books. I do think, though, that if we want to prevent identity theft, and it's increasing every year, and even if you take a look at testimony and reports, one, this just came out just several months ago from the GAO. You can go on and on. We still have to do things about Social Security numbers. Does this bill do some aspects of that? No. It will do in terms of the public entities and all that, and with the reselling and things like that, but does it with increasing things and all that? There needs to be other kinds of things that need to be done. And it seems like that businesses, they still want to use the Social Security numbers, the main identifier, main authenticator, things like that, but they're not willing to take a look at things of maybe to truncate numbers to where they only use 4 or 5 numbers or whatever. And this leads me to the point to where, as I did some research on the web, TransUnion, which is one of the credit reporting agencies, because one of the things that was talked about is, hey, credit reporting agencies, you know, are having problems or whatever. And this is dated basically from June, July of 2007. And how they described the Minnesota law that was going to take effect next year, but then what happened? In Minnesota, in 2006, Minnesota passed a law requiring that businesses not sell Social Security numbers obtained through the course of business. And that's one of the reasons why that was put in, because you keep away the dissemination of that number to less and for specific purposes. This would have forced TransUnion to truncate the SSN on all data output products and services, such as credit reports and whatever. Because it's not just the businesses that get these, it's also other kind of entities. This would have forced TransUnion to truncate the SSN on all their products and services. As originally acted, the law was to become effective July 1st. However, on May 22nd, in the Data Practices Committee, doesn't say that, but it was passed that moves the law's effective date to July 1st. Now, with TransUnion knowing this, this is what they told basically in their legislative update. This amendment did not alter the compliance requirement that TransUnion truncate SSNs on output. Rather, it delayed the compliance date. Thus, TransUnion has made the decision to defer the mandatory SSN truncation change to all customers until July 1st, 2008, to ease the operational impact on our customers as well as our own business. We will allow our customers to make this change to their online transactions. So I'm not aware of what the current law deals with truncating in terms of the selling of their numbers, but TransUnion has some idea of. And to me, you know, one of the things is this is a big issue, and you as the consumer, the Commerce Committee, you want to protect people's IDs and all that. So I bring up that as a point.
And Mr. then secondly, Neumeister, forgive me if I could just interrupt you, because I'm wondering, are you suggesting that the credit reporting companies can sell the Social Security number just for the value of the Social Security number itself? I think this language includes
I think,
that activity.
I hope that does. But I'm just saying that what the GAO report says, that is that's an industry. The industry does that. Also, what information resellers, Choice Point, that was already been talked about, does those things. You know, whether or not Choice Point, Mr. Apitz, who represents the credit reporting agency, is going to be on record and say that here, I don't know if they'll say that. But, you know, I think it's important that, because this law is going to become effective, even though it's been on the books for 3 years, it hasn't been effective.
Right.
And we want to make sure what it does. The other aspect of the change is in the words on line 134. It's basically the new language on 1.32 through 1.135. One of the things that I've always felt it's very important, what does it mean? And that's not something, you know, give me two or three examples of what does it mean when there's no economic value and this and this. And maybe in the bank it's pretty clear, but you got to remember there's information resellers, the Choice Points of the world, and all that also have your Social Security number. So I think it's important for folks to understand really what it does. And thirdly, and this is more of a judiciary issue, is that...
And the bill's going there
right,
after here.
Is to have enforcement, as the original bill, which was placated last year, there were some good things in that bill in 2390. One is that it says a person violating this section is subject to the penalties and remedies in Section 831. If you don't have good remedies, you're going to have a law that looks good and reads good, but is not going to do any good. And if you ask the folks, CRAs and all that, well, what about that provision? They hate it. So, Madam Chair and members of the Commerce Committee, because I have been out with a cold, I haven't had until just less than an hour ago, this was my first opportunity to take a look at the amendment. Madam Chair and members of the committee, you know that I raise points, I raise questions. I haven't yet done the full research that I usually do. I feel comfortable, you know, with it going, but just some of those kinds of things to get on the record that I've highlighted and maybe put that remedy section in. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the few moments
here. Thank
you,
and I loved that movie, even if it made me sad. Members, do you have any questions? Is there anybody else here who would like to speak? Anyone else? I don't see that anyone will. So, members, no more questions. Senator Marty wants to move that Senate File 2390, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
That's correct. If I may just correct.
Yes, Senator Betzold.
One slight thing. Mr. Neumeister said that we made the correction on May 22nd, and since the session ended May 21st, that would not have been correct last year. So.
Well, I'm glad we have that cleared. Thank you. So, no further questions, discussion. All those in favor of the Marty motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and... the bill will be re-referred, and Senator Betzold is staying there.
I'll have to give a minute for half the room to clear out, or at least whatever.
Some fraction.
Some fraction
will. Okay. So, members, now we're going to do number one on the agenda. Yes. Senate File, well, we'll wait a minute here. Make sure that Senator Betzold has one. I don't need any of this stuff now. Sure. So I can put this away.
Oh, that's true. That's a good thing.
Oh,
it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
pawn shops.
Thank you.
And so, but that doesn't mean.
I don't. They may let you have forget this bill. We had a delete all, which just I may have another copy here. Which is, that was a bill I was introduced. It's not the copy.
I just put this in
to delete all. This is what we adopted here.
Is that okay?
Yeah, you can have that one in. Okay, thanks.
Hey. Senator Betzold, I think it was about half.
There you go.
You do know how to fill a hearing room here.
You know how to do one out, too.
Senator Betzold, Senate File 2294.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill has a little bit more interest, of course, with some parties, and if this bill does move out of here, it would also have to go to Judiciary Committee. This came to my attention late last session, mainly because of the data issues that I'll describe in a moment. And a bill was introduced and so forth, and people have to understand a bill is introduced is not necessarily as it's going to proceed, but some people seem fixated on the fact that a bill is introduced to a certain language, and we're always open to discussion and possible to, ways to improve bills. So I would urge people who have strong opposition to this bill to be as open as I am to your suggestions. Pawn shops are regulated by statute and local ordinance, and it's not my intention to change that. That's been the way for about 100 years or so, and to the extent that they're regulated, occasionally, stolen property is brought to pawn shops. I'm told, and there's experts in here that can probably provide better data than I've got, but I'm told that about 0.3% at most of pawn shop transactions involve stolen goods. I guess that's 3 out of 1,000, and there's thousands and thousands of transactions. I will suggest that it might take a stupid criminal to take a pawn shop, an item of stolen goods, to a pawn shop, which is regulated and data is collected, but criminals tend to be stupid. I mean, they'd be better off to bring it to secondhand stores or sell it on eBay or whatever, but this bill doesn't correct that at all. My interest came was in 1997, the city of Minneapolis created a system to track pawn shop transactions. It's called the APS, the Automatic Pawn System. It's a computerized system, and under that system, customers of pawn shops are required to produce personal information about themselves, which is collected by the pawn shop about their customers, and then data is collected about each pawn shop transaction. And in addition, in order to pay for the system, a fee is collected to help pay for the system for each pawn shop transaction. That Minneapolis system has been expanded to many other jurisdictions. And the other jurisdictions, law enforcement jurisdictions, are required by contract to abide by this APS system. That is to collect the personal data on the person and the property, collect the fee, which I believe is remitted to the city of Minneapolis, and they can collect additional fees for their own local use if they wish to do so. But then all the information goes into this database that everybody has access to. And it isn't just law enforcement agencies that can subscribe to the system, although I'm told that the personal information is not necessarily shared with private organizations, but the property transactions are. And in fact, we have a classifications in the Data Practices Act that says that the property transactions are public data. So if anybody wants to go down to your local police department and get a complete list of all pawn shop transactions in the state of Minnesota, you can do that because it's all public data. This spurred my interest because, I'm interested in knowing why, what, and how much personal data is being collected. Why is it being collected? I mean, it's for law enforcement purposes, but why is every item being collected for citizens who go to do business at pawn shops? I want to know how it's being used. I've had an interest in that. Who does really have access to the data. As an example, there's a police department in Wisconsin, I believe, that is a subscriber to the system. Well, they're not bound by the Data Practices Act. They do sign a contract, which I've looked at, and it doesn't require them, at least the contract that I looked does not require them to follow Minnesota law, because this is actually a creation of a Minneapolis ordinance. I guess questions can be raised on the fee. You know, is the fee proper? How is the fee being used? Is the fee being only used for this purpose or for other purposes? That may be a possible topic for the legislative auditor, but, you know, the system, I think, in my mind, has raised a number of issues. As I indicated, I introduced this bill late last year, and I do have an author's amendment, an A1 amendment, to at least make some modifications of the bill, put the bill in the shape that I'd like to proceed, Madam Chair. So if somebody could move the A1 amendment, this is the first stop of the bill, so then we can at least operate under some revised language here.
Senator Prettner-Solon will move adoption of the A1 amendment and author's amendment. Any questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion fails. The amendment's adopted.
And Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to witnesses in a few minutes. And you've got people here who support the bill and many people who oppose it. And I've heard from a number of people over the past couple of months. I'm certainly willing to listen to concerns. And I think there's some workable solutions that we have in here. Frankly, I'm uncomfortable with a system that requires a private industry to collect private data, share it, collect a fee with no review whatsoever by the legislature. I'm told that other states have a similar system that requires pawn shops to collect data, but the law enforcement systems have to pay to join the system. The agencies who want access to it cannot just get it just because it's turned over to them. They actually have to have a reason for it, like a report of stolen property. So the A1 amendment that was adopted does require changes to the bill that require that there would have to be at least an open case number to access the data instead of the pawn shops requiring responding 3 calendar days. They'd have to do in 24 hours to make modifications to the fee that's being charged, because apparently that was a huge issue to the cities. Now, again, how the fee is being used and so forth, I really have no understanding for right now, except what they tell me, but I'm sure you'll be hearing more of it. Anyway, let me just turn the witness table over to. I'll stand for any questions if anybody has them, but I've got witnesses here who can testify for the bill.
Okay, Mr. Cassidy, did you want to go first?
Thank you, Senator Betzel. Madam Chair, members, my name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Leonard Street and Diner. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 2294 on behalf of our client, Pawn America. Joining me today is Brad Rixman, the CEO of Pawn America. For those of you who don't know, Pawn America is a Minnesota-based corporation with 14 retail stores located throughout Minnesota, supporting 140 employees and serving an average of over 70,000 customers on an annual basis. Our customers, most of whom are Minnesota residents, are law-abiding, trusting citizens that come from every walk of life, including every geographic area of the state of Minnesota and every income level imaginable. Pawn America is supportive of the Minneapolis automated pawn system. We participated in the discussions that created the system. This legislation is not about abolishing the APS or limiting its capabilities. However, we are recommending the changes contained in Senate File 2294 due to growing concerns over access to its customers' personal data and the rising costs associated with transaction fees charged upon America's customers. The original intent of the APS system was to afford the law enforcement community an investigative tool that made tracking pawn and secondhand transactions more efficient and cost-effective. Today we find a system that increasingly relies on open, unfettered access to average citizens' personal data and ever-increasing transaction fees. The APS program, originally implemented in 1997, is very simple. If you go to a pawn shop in a local community that participates in the APS system, you'll have to provide certain personal identifying information about yourself and information on the item you are either A, using as collateral for a pawn loan, or B, selling as a secondhand good. Unfortunately, the regulation of how, when, and why law enforcement accesses the personal information of our customers was never contemplated when Minneapolis implemented the first APS program. Today, law enforcement officials across the state have unfettered access to APS data, which includes a person's name, or may include a person's name, address, birth date, physical description, height, weight, hair color, eye color, and possibly even race. As part of the transaction, you must provide all this personal information, be photographed, and paid a fee to support the APS system. Some local jurisdictions, including Fridley, charge fees as high as $3 per transaction. The information downloaded into the APS system is managed by the City of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Police Department. The APS as developed 12 years ago was not very prescriptive or instructive. The system does not address a number of issues that Senator Betzold has addressed and have now become concerns of ours. These are concerns that were first raised by legislators last year when we went through the scrap metal debate, which I know many of you went through with us. We attempt to address these concerns in Senate File 2294. Let me run through them for you, and these all address the amendments that were just adopted. First, with regard to personal information sharing, the legislation clearly defines what is customer data to include personal information, physical description, and electronic data such as photographs and driver's licenses. Number two, secondhand dealers would now be subjected to the APS system and be included statewide under this proposal. The secondhand retail market, as you know, has exploded in recent years. Retail stores such as franchise secondhand stores and consignment shops are a new market. This is a new market that allows criminals to bypass law enforcement and pawn stores without having to be subjected to the APS system as it currently exists. The Internet and eBay are another market, as Senator Betzel referred to, but that's a fight that we can fight on another day. The proposal requires that law enforcement officials also provide an active case number before they can access customer data contained within the APS. The proposal also requires businesses, pawn shops, and secondhand goods dealers participating in the APS to respond to data requests from law enforcement within 24 hours. Currently, there also is no mechanism to track who is accessing the APS system and for what purpose. This proposal requires that APS administrators keep track of those data requests. And finally, Madam Chair, this proposal puts some parameters around the fees that could be charged by the APS system and local jurisdictions. Pawn stores already pay steep licensing fees to operate in most local jurisdictions to cover the cost of regulation. Their customers should not have to pay a penalty of up to $3 per transaction as well. This proposal suggests a modest fee at $1 per transaction and up to 50 cents per transaction to cover administrative overhead, which goes to the City of Minneapolis for administration of the program. Given the proposed expansion of the APS program to include secondhand transactions, this should more than cover any reduction that would be experienced by jurisdictions that currently charge more. Madam Chair and Member, this proposal does not attempt to do away with the Minneapolis automated pawn system. It simply puts some reasonable parameters around how it operates and how it is administered. We believe these proposals are reasonable and make the system stronger and more efficient while protecting our customers' personal information. Thank you again, and Mr. Rixman and I would be happy to stand for questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Cassidy? Yes, Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cassidy, you listed off some I had written out a question here of what data is actually collected. What are we talking about? And you listed off a list of items, but then you said that those are things that may be collected. Is there a standard? I'm unaware of how this works. I'm just trying to learn this. Is there a standard when someone comes in with a transaction and say, okay, here's a DVD player or my kid's trumpet, whatever it is, I'm going to pawn this, at that point of transaction, the clerk at the shop will take down information. Is that standardized, required
Cassidy.
For the APS system? And because you said,
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I think I'll refer to Mr. Rixman to answer that question, but I think it goes jurisdiction by jurisdiction according to the contractual arrangement they have with the APS system. So,
Mr. Rixman, did you want to?
I will. Brad Rixman, I'm the CEO of Pawn America. Madam Chair, members of the Commerce Committee. Yes, we're required to retain and obtain, submit to the automated pawn system personal identifying information on our customers, which includes driver's license number, first, middle, last name, height, weight, hair color, eye color, gender, race, any identifying marks, along with the identification of the product, which we take in as collateral for a pawn loan or that we purchase through a secondhand goods transaction. On the identification on the product that we take in is an item like or a manufacturer, model number, serial number, identifying information on the product. Jewelry is like type of gold, ring size, precious stone size, etc., quantity of items purchased. We submit the dollar amount, which was advanced to the customer as well.
Awesome. So, Madam Chair,
Senator Gerlach,
that long list of information you have, so when every customer that brings something in, you take down all of that information on every transaction?
Mr. Rixman.
Yes, we do.
All right.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Mr. Rixman, did you wish to then testify also, or are you there just to answer questions?
I'm available to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Is there anybody else, Senator Betzel, that you have? Okay, I have some people who wish to express their concerns. Is Mayor Lund here? Yes, okay. And then Chief Abbott as well. You might as well go up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and senators of this committee. I do have a handout.
I just need you to identify yourself.
Scott Lund, Mayor Fridley.
Thank you.
If you're page, or if you're so inclined, Madam Chair, I do have a one-page handout for the committee members that talks of our stance and of the League of Minnesota Cities. Just so that everyone's clear, I am adamantly opposed to this action of the Senate File 2294, at least in its current form. I wanted to alert members of this committee of my personal and city's opposition to this. We do charge $3 per transaction. And the way that came about is in my belief, and it was brought to my attention through our local police department, for the need for regulation and oversight, at least in our local level. We have two pawn shops that are currently licensed in the city of Fridley. And I can't tell you, I can't think of, and it came up in public testimony, of any other industry that requires a full-time police officer to oversight or regulate two businesses in one industry, such as the pawn shops. The senator mentioned about 0.3% of all transactions, way less than 1%. We firmly believe that that is just the tip of the iceberg. The amount of criminal activity that occurs because of the nature of pawn shop activity, I think, is astronomically higher than that. We're just scratching the surface. I get police reports every week from our single police detective that regulates and does the oversight of those two pawn shops. He can't even begin to handle all the business at hand with the illegal activity and the ancillary or secondary cause, which it relates to drug trafficking or illegal drug use. Many pawn shop people are stealing goods, as we probably all know, and then converting it at pawn shops or secondhand stores, wherever, the internet, eBay, all kinds of tools are at their avail to get cash to further their illegal drug activities or whatever. So I really am opposed to the restriction of licensing or the cost thereof or our ability to charge a transaction fee. I can tell you why we came to $3. We were charging $1.50. $1 goes for each item to the APS system, which I think is a very viable system that Minneapolis has. And I hope that that will continue. The 50 cents was to the city of Fridley for administrative, but we really didn't have the ability nor the funds available for an additional police officer. So to pay for his salary and all the costs associated with that, so we raised the fee to $3 after much public discussion to help assist in that payment of a police officer for the purposes of regulating two businesses in our community. So I think it's one of the better pieces of legislation that I have created that we have done in the city of Fridley on a local level. I would ask that this committee strongly look at not restricting the local police departments or local units of government in restricting us and how and our abilities to capture all this illegal activity that is occurring. And again, just the tip of the iceberg. The senator made comment at his introduction about being open-minded, and I hope he is. As to this point, we invited him to the city of Fridley, and he abruptly left, and we never got our viewpoints across. So I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that to the senator in this body since he brought it up. I think that it would be an addition. I know that it would be an additional burden to the taxpayers of our community if reductions occurred in that. We do not have the ability to pay for this officer, and only by virtue of increasing the fees have we had that ability. We, like many communities, as a first-ring suburb of this metro area, we are at a huge loss with the 2003 budget cuts in our LGA, where we get virtually nothing, and we are now operating out of in the red each and every year since 2003, and only surviving by our reserves, which are quickly depleting. So we do not have the ability to add towards police officers. So we think that it's important. The last comment I want to make from my viewpoint, that I have had the firm belief that industry should self-regulate. They should regulate their own industry. Only when they fail should government step in. At least that's my belief on a local level. And the reason why we stepped in on the local level is because we believe that they have done a poor job of self-regulation. There is way too much criminal activity going on there. And we still, even with the advent of our police officer doing oversight, they routinely, either purposely or unintentionally, do not adequately describe the items even to the APS system, that our officer must look at every item virtually to see that it is properly inputted, because, you know, garbage in, garbage out. You don't have the, if you're describing somebody's $5,000 piece of jewelry that was not, it may be tough to describe accurately, and if it's not accurately described, it won't be caught on the APS system when we're doing our daily. We're having people in-house daily looking for a hit on stolen merchandise through the APS system. Again, it's the tip of the iceberg, so please do not create more restrictive legislation that hampers the ability of local units of government. Don't take away the tools that they now have. We need more tools, not less tools, to capture the criminal activity that occurs. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mayor. I've been kind of, as you've been speaking, I've been listening, but I glanced through some of the events, if you will, the times that the police in Fridley had contact with pawn shop and people who are trying to pawn, in many cases here, stolen property. It looks, and I think in something that I read, you also show that you've gotten a lot more cooperation since you've been actively going after pawn crime, if you will, on the part of people who have stolen merchandise. It looks like you're getting, though, it looks like the pawn shops are calling. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm naive. I've never been in one. I've thought about it sometimes, but and I've wondered, how would a person, a pawnbroker, know that somebody was bringing in something stolen? I mean, I see somebody brought in a TV, they didn't know anything about it. You know, maybe if I came in with a snowblower, although I don't know, maybe I would.
Madam Chair, if
what's the clue?
Madam Chair, thanks for the question. And yes, I will say that there has been more cooperation since our creation of a police officer or detective in the oversight. But that cooperation, it came after, not before, our introduction of a full-time police detective. As to your question about you've never been in a pawn shop, you thought about, if you legitimately have, and I'm not suggesting that it's totally an illegal business, but it sure is a great avenue for an awful lot of potential for illegal activity. And we firmly believe that, again, it's the tip of the iceberg. But as to your question about getting in, would you have a problem? I guess I wouldn't have a problem if somebody's asking me for identification, like my driver's license, and taking an imprint of that. You can't get rid of it. You can't utilize your checking account or a check at any place unless you submit and prove who you are instead of writing out a check. And I don't think that they're really profiling at all. I think that there should be maybe some limitations as to who has access to all that information or where it's kept. There are federal regulations, as well as state regulation that you're probably more aware of than I am, that does restrict the ability of people gathering information and how they utilize or make use of that. And they have to protect your privacy when they grab that information, or they can be held accountable. I wouldn't have any objection if I was trying to pawn a TV set of mine or a snowblower or what have you. I wouldn't have an objection because I'm honestly there for an honest purpose. But I think that with the amount of activity that does have the potential for illegal activity, this should hamper. If this committee or what a bill or an introduction of further legislation, maybe it should say clearly that there has to be some a sign right on a prominent location that you will be photographed, you will be, personal information will be gathered. Maybe that'll stop them, or maybe, as the senator made, they're stupid or dumb, and they may be smart enough in this case not to come in there and try to attempt to pawn the stolen goods. So I think that we should keep a firm hand on who's coming in there and what they're selling.
Okay, Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mayor, the fee issue, first of all, I'm undecided about this bill, and I've had a lot of information come from different sides. I'm trying to sort this out. On the fee issue, there's quite a range of this. I was told that Burnsville charges $1.20, a dollar going to the APS system, 20 cents being retained by the city. Fridley, you've got $3. So, I mean, that's quite a gap. Why is Burnsville able to handle this with 20 cents a transaction and Fridley needs $2 or 10 times the amount? What accounts for the disparity in that?
Madam Chair, Senator, good question. Burnsville may, and I don't know their interworkings or their finances, they may have the ability to better fund a police officer. I don't know that they even have, and other officers in this room may be able to address that more specifically. They may not have a full-time dedicated officer just for oversight of, in Fridley's case, two pawn shops. We need, even with the additional of 150, we were at 150. We were only really responding to complaint basis only. That's what our police department was doing. We felt and found that there's such a significant amount, in our opinion, of potential illegal activity or illegal activity going on based on only complaint basis now, that we felt, and our officers, our police department felt very strongly that they needed to have better oversight. And we came up with $1.50 in addition to help fund the police officer's salary. It does not pay for it 100%, but I will admit that $1.50 per transaction does equate to probably about three-quarters or so of the officer's salary and the other costs associated with that officer, like his hospitalization, vacation pay, a portion of his the office use, those types of things. We now still in-house at included in that, which is over and above, we do have two technicians, police technicians, that routinely check the hits for items at our local pawn shop, and if they are entered into the APS system, and see if there's a hit on somebody looking for their stolen merchandise. And we find many pieces of merchandise in the Fridley pawn shops that even belong outside of Fridley, that it's community-wide, it's metro-wide, it's statewide.
Senator Gerlach.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been told that the adding in secondhand stores broadens the base of this. Have you considered that? Does that, now I'm not sold on the idea that I like that necessarily, but if this bill were to be enacted, it does seem to broaden the base by adding other retailers, other folks in these secondhand stores in with that additional amount. Does that, have you done any calculations, does that solve your problem on the funding your police officer?
Mayor Lund.
Madam Chair, Senator, another good question. We do have a secondhand store in Fridley, Tried and True Tools, and there has been some illegal activity that we've caught in that. I'm not necessarily opposed to that inclusion of secondhand stores in legislation. Those transactions, but we have not included that as of yet, and maybe that will aid in a furtherance of that police officer's pay. So if you're suggesting that maybe we can overall reduce that 150 additional charge to a total of three to 275 or some other number, again, I have to remind you that our officer, I think, that's in the room today, our detective that oversees those two, he would increase his workload. He had already has admitted publicly that at one of our council meetings that it's job security. He can't handle all the stuff that's going on already. So adding to his workload will not necessarily decrease those fees. We don't have enough money now to hire another detective to handle the extra workload.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more then on the fee issue. Mr. Mayor, if the bill says it's essentially a maximum of a dollar and a half, then if that was a dollar for the fee and then a maximum of $2 for the administrative portion, that gets you to your $3. If that were in place, does that take your problems, that solve your problem, and or are there other areas of the bill that?
Well, again, it's state regulating what the city's ability to do, and every city is a little different. Our ability or inability under our general fund makes it very tough for us. If you do impose a limit of $2, we'll obviously have to live within that means. But at some point, with inflation and other add-ons, as we have more stores, like secondhand stores that are now being regulated, or having oversight, how much will that add to the workload, and how much will that? We may at some point have to go to 3.25 or 3.50. I understand, you know, in industry or in business, you know, this is seems like a high fee at $3. I questioned it much like you are, Senator, when this first came to our attention at the City Council. We did not take this lightly about hitting our businesses up with a high fee of $3. Plus, they do pay a license fee. But on the other hand, again, that's where my belief has been, let industry self-regulate. They should regulate and fix their own problems in-house and in their industry. If they can't, and in my opinion they have not, then government steps in, and in this case Fridley, local unit of government, stepped in. So, and keep in mind, that's only one aspect that that has opposition with me and with others, and that is removing that tool of getting information, private information. They want to restrict it on who has access? Certainly.
Okay. Chief Abbott, did you wish to speak? Then you want to testify as well.
I do, Madam Chair.
I'll tell the committee that there's a packet of information from the chief here as well that everybody should have.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to address you in opposition of Senate File 2294 today. I am Don Abbott, Chief of Police for the City of Fridley. Technically, my title is a Director of Public Safety, if you see that on the materials as well. The City of Fridley has a keen and significant interest in opposing any restriction on our ability to license and regulate pawnbrokers, including the levying of fees sufficient to cover at least a portion of the cost of that regulation. The City of Fridley has two licensed pawnbrokers and ranks second in total pawn transactions in the state of Minnesota. Only St. Paul has more transactions than does the City of Fridley. My purpose in addressing you today is threefold. First, I wish to voice our opposition to any restriction on the ability of local units of government to license and regulate the pawn industry operating within our borders. I believe the mayor has spoken very well to that issue already here today. Second, the City of Fridley strongly opposes any legislation that would reduce our ability to effectively investigate criminal activity occurring in or related to our city. Finally, the City of Fridley would recommend three enhancements to current statutes regulating pawnbrokers that would afford additional consumer protections to customers of pawnbrokers. It is well known and accepted within the police profession and quite honestly on the streets of our communities that pawnbrokers afford thieves with an easy method of quickly converting stolen property into cash. To counteract that activity, the state of Minnesota leaves the licensing and regulation of pawnbrokers to the local communities in which they are located. The City of Fridley desires to retain our ability to license and regulate this industry within our borders and urges you to make no changes to restrict or hamper us in that effort. The current file would significantly impair our ability to accomplish our regulatory function, as this regulation needs to occur, and if cities are precluded from effective regulation, is the state then prepared to assume that role and those duties? The City of Fridley depends upon unfettered access to all article and personal descriptive data currently collected and maintained by the automated pawn system. The system, which was created by the City of Minneapolis at their expense, allows subscribing agencies to require pawnbrokers within their jurisdictions to electronically enter the descriptions of property offered as security on a loan or as an outright sale to pawnbrokers, as well as the personal identity and the descriptions of those persons offering the articles for sale or pawn into the APS system. The APS database conducts automated queries against the national database of items reported stolen. Due to limited information available both on pawned property and in the stolen property database, we estimate that in less than 20% of these cases is an automated check possible. We rely upon detectives and technicians running manual checks to review the remaining 80% of these articles for matches to stolen property. All of this takes time and imposes an expense upon already resource-constrained local law enforcement agencies. In many cases, stolen articles are not completely or accurately described by crime victims. In most cases, there are no suspects even suggested to police. In these cases, detectives query the APS database for articles matching the description of the reported stolen property and then review those persons who pawned or sold the items to the pawnbrokers. Many cases have been made when a detective reviews several similar items, finds the name of a known local criminal, a family member of the victim who was not previously a suspect, or in some cases, the victims themselves who have pawned the article and then reported it stolen in a false report to police. Hampering our ability to quickly access the names and physical descriptions of persons pawning property would absolutely result in fewer cases solved, less stolen property returned to its rightful owners, and unprosecuted criminals who would be free to continue their unlawful activities. Even in those cases where probable cause to make a written request for personal data associated with possible stolen property would exist, the additional time required to assemble those facts and present them in such a fashion, and then to wait, originally it was up to 3 days. I understand we're looking at 24 hours now. But even a 24-hour wait for that data to be provided by the pawnbroker would necessarily result in a delay and fewer cases being worked by police, given the same amount of detective resources. The City of Minneapolis incurred considerable expense in developing APS and funds the staffing and resources necessary to continue its operation. For that service, the City of Minneapolis charges subscribing agencies $1 per transaction entered by their pawnbrokers. The City of Fridley levies an additional $2 per transaction to partially fund the additional expense of regulating pawnbrokers in our city. In 2006, the city took in just over $90,000 in pawnbroker fees and expended just over $120,000 in our regulatory effort. This amount represents the annual salary and benefits of our dedicated full-time pawn detective. Barry Pankin is with us today for additional questions, if you wish. 8 hours a week for technician time. That's a non-sworn person to assist us with the clerical work. The APS fee that we could then pay to the City of Minneapolis and the expenses associated with Detective Pankinen's office, vehicle supplies, and so on. You may hear, have already heard, I believe that very few items are ultimately discovered stolen in pawnbrokers' inventories, representing only one quarter to one third of all pawned items. Fridley's experience over the last 2 years of enhanced regulation shows that is an accurate number. What the numbers don't tell, however, is that these figures represent 219 stolen items in 2006, with an estimated market value of approximately $140,000. These are valuable items stolen from real people. We're very happy to have them returned to their possession. And those figures don't represent the additional items recovered by Fridley police officers each year at the pawn shops, but prior to their entry into APS. These incidents typically occur about 100 times a year, and involve persons caught attempting to pawn or sell items that they don't own, but prior to the completion of the pawn transaction. Given the aforementioned difficulties in matching items taken in by pawnbrokers with items reported stolen, we're now looking at approximately 300 potentially stolen items every year, and they do not represent the sum total of stolen property traffic through the pawnbrokers any more than the 1,700 speeding tickets issued by Fridley Police in 2006 represent every incidence of speeding in our city. Finally, we would challenge anyone to name another industry in our city other than pawnbrokers and secondhand dealers, whose inventory contains known quantities of stolen property on a regular basis. For us not to concern ourselves with this amount of known stolen property would mean it would be acceptable for the new car dealer in our city to sell 8 to 10 stolen cars every year. Finally, given that we do have an opportunity to discuss regulation of pawnbrokers in an attempt to enhance consumer protection, the City of Fridley would like to take an opportunity to present three additional protections we feel would provide significant benefits and protections to some of the more vulnerable members of our society. We've provided you in the packet with actual language suggestions and where in statute we would see those items fitting. First, you're receiving a copy of an actual pawnbroker's ticket for a recent transaction in the City of Fridley. You will see that the annual effective interest rate for this transaction exceeds 300%. We can tell you that while this rate is typical of pawn transactions we review, we have observed transactions wherein the effective annual rate exceeds 500%. Minnesota Statute 325J.07 caps the interest rate called the pawnbroker fee by statute at 36% per annum or 3% per month. The statute then allows pawnbrokers to charge additional reasonable fees for storage and handling fees typically, but does not define what reasonable means. We're left to regulate something then that's based largely undefined. Our proposal is that you adopt the language capping and defining these reasonable fees at an additional 3% as month per well, making the maximum annual effective rate limited to 72%. Second, our recommendation would be to basically a retirement or a requirement that all licensed pawnbrokers, anyone conducting business as a licensed pawnbroker, would include that identification, specifically the word pawnbroker, in any signage or advertisements related to their business, would clearly indicate to potential customers that the business is a pawnbroker and is likely to charge maximum fees for loans. Finally, the state of Minnesota does not currently require persons offering articles as security for loans made by pawnbrokers to actually have a legal interest in that property. The City of Fridley, as have a few other jurisdictions, makes it a misdemeanor ordinance violation for someone to pawn something they don't own. This manifests itself most often when the person is confronted by the pawnbroker or the police concerning their suspect ownership in the property. Persons of this type arouse suspicion when they cannot answer questions about what the item is, what it does, or how it works. Usually the person admits they don't own the property, frequently claiming that they are pawning it as a favor for a friend or a relative whose name happens to escape them at the moment. Our officers confiscate the property and hold it for proof of ownership, which, by the way, is seldom ever provided. Detective Pankinen works to determine ownership of the property and return it to the owner if possible. He's able to do that in about 50% of these cases. In those instances where ownership is never determined, the city disposes of the property pursuant to provisions of our city code. In either event, Detective Pankinen works diligently to charge the person who offered the property with possession of stolen property, or failing that, our misdemeanor violation of our code for pawning the property of another. Our recommendation in this area is to include language in Chapter 609, which is a criminal code, making offering property to secure a loan by a licensed pawnbroker when the person offering the property does not have a legal interest in that property a crime. This would have the benefit of making this a crime statewide and would allow for penalties to escalate with the value of the property. Misdemeanor code, city code violations are limited to the misdemeanor level only, no matter what the value of the property is. We also recommend making it a crime for any licensed pawnbroker or an employee to accept as security items they know or reasonably should know the person offering has no legal interest in. This change would make loans made by pawnbrokers consistent with statutory provisions governing secured loans made by other financial institutions. This concludes my formal presentation, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak to your committee today. I'm present, as are several members of my staff, including our full-time pawn detective, Pankinen. Gary Rattari is the administrative representative for the City of Minneapolis for APS, is here as well. If you have any questions.
Okay, do members have any questions? Chief? Okay, is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate that very much. This actually has kind of a personal meaning for me, Madam Chair, because last May, my daughter and her husband, who lived in the Seward area at the time, their home was burglarized, and they were told that the types of items that were taken were probably items that would typically be pawned. And they did receive some help from law enforcement, but because of the extent of the problem, they were told, and how severe it is, they were really left on their own to try to go from pawn shop to pawn shop and look to see whether their property might be have been pawned. And they really didn't have the capabilities to do that. So so I really am concerned about doing something that, when we know that we have a criminal problem that certainly is probably not the vast majority, but we certainly know it exists, that will we do it, anything that would limit law enforcement's ability to deal with that problem.
Okay. Is there anybody else who would like to testify?
Yes, ma'am.
Please come forward and identify yourself. And thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. I'm Sergeant Mike Simmons with the St. Paul Police Department.
Is it Mike Simmons?
Mike Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S.
Okay.
And I've been involved with, I handle the pawn shop detail in the city of St. Paul for the last 5 years. As I listened, Madam, I think I can answer a couple of your questions. I know you asked, how does a pawn shop know, for example, if something's stolen? I believe that maybe the committee here feels people are just bringing in one item or something, which, in my opinion, it would be hard to know. But I can give you examples. Once again, I do believe in the data practice laws that there are, so I can't give you names, but I can tell you about items that they bring in, for example. So I'll just give you a few examples to give you an idea of the kind of numbers we're talking about here. In 3 months, this particular party brought in 55 brand-new MP3 players to the same pawn shop. Brand new, in the box, with the receipt, with the paperwork, you name it. Another example: in a year and a half period, one party brought in 44 brand new DVD players to different pawn shops, but they're all brand new, in the box, with paperwork, etc.
Sergeant Simmons, you know that because of the APS system.
Correct.
Put into the APS
you
system.
You are able to identify. You can query items. You can query people. Etc. And certainly by querying items, I find cases involving stolen property, etc. Like the examples I could continue to give you. I just have one small file with me. I have many back at my desk. These are people who are boosters, which are, in law enforcement terms, steal for a living. They steal brand new items, and they bring a lot of this stuff into the pawn shops. And when it becomes the numbers we're talking about, it's obvious that the pawn shop should know. I go to my pawn shops and tell them if it's new, there's a problem. Why would you come to a pawn shop with a $300 item and pawn it for $50? Now, I've found some examples where people have done that, maybe gifts from Florida or et cetera, but it's very infrequent. I could waste your time all day with talking about 100, and in some cases, I'm telling you, 63 nail guns, 75 nail guns.
By the same person.
By the same person in a year or two period. It's outrageous. And a lot of these people get away with it. Because one of the other main problems on the other end of this is identifying some of this stolen property, unquestionably. But these pawn shops need to be regulated. They do buy stolen property. Whether they mean to or not, it happens on a daily, weekly basis. We find numerous items. In 2007, the city of St. Paul recovered 340 items from the pawn shops with a reported value of about $270,000. I know of no other company or industry in the city of St. Paul where we recover that kind of property. I haven't seen it anywhere. Once again, like I say, I could bore you with these items. 20 computers for one particular person. In some cases, these boosters, one guy brought in 450 brand new items, all brand new tools, to numerous pawn shops over about a 4-year period. I mean, the numbers are ridiculous. It's here. It's factual. There's no question about it. So I wanted to just let you know that. I know you asked the question, how do they know it's stolen property? Mm-hmm. Now, some of my pawn shops would tell me, Sergeant, you don't believe how many people we send away from the stores. I don't have that data, of course, but the bottom line is I look at what they do purchase. And they are knowledgeable enough in the business to know when the same person brings in 4 to 15 brand-new items in a package, they should know that there's a problem. And law enforcement should be called. So this is the kind of stuff that is here. There's no question. There's a problem. They need to be, oversight on the pawn shops.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just quickly, how does this bill prevent
this from being stopped?
Well, Sergeant Simmons.
Yeah, this bill doesn't appear to prevent it from being stopped. One of the issues appears to be, apparently they're talking about where the data goes and who it can be shared with. It certainly needs to be shared with pawn shops. But let's just talk about, I guess, the fees, for example. I handle the pawn shop detail alone in the city of St. Paul, although investigators in property crimes have access to this data. The bottom line is I could have probably two other people work just the pawn shop detail if we did surveillance and put the time and effort towards these suspects who are bringing this in. So back to the money issue, the city of St. Paul has raised their fee one time since 1997 in 10 years. And as we all know, costs go up. So the $3 fee is reasonable. So I guess my argument, I wanted to inform you of how they know this is, should know this is stolen property and the amount coming in, and that, in my opinion, the fee is more than reasonable. And when, like, I know that the chief mentioned the pawn shop fees, we could talk about reasonable and unreasonable, exactly who's getting the bang for the buck and how much money they're paying in pawn shop fees with storage fees, handling fees, and interest versus a $3 fee, which, by the way, in some cases, they pass on to their customers. So, sir, my argument would be that the $3 fee is legitimate and well worth the money spent. And in some cases, it's paid by the customer, who, according to the people who run the pawn shops, they tell me, the managers who I've dealt with for years, they don't seem to have a problem with that in most cases.
I have a question, Sergeant Simmons, on when somebody's brought in, I don't know if they were iPods or what you said, it was that somebody had 40-some?
Correct, 44 iPods.
Did they bring them all at once, or did they just over a period of time and to the same store?
In this case, it was the same pawn shop. Not in my city, but it was the same pawn shop, and they brought them over a 2.5-month period. But 44 iPods. I called the owner of that store. Now, it's out of my jurisdiction. I also called the police officer who handles it. And basically, the owner told me, I downloaded the information through the APS system. You figure it out. And now the problem here is, the store, this is a real retail problem. Walmart, Kmart, Sears, Home Depot, Radio Shack, you name it, they really do not keep a good system on serial numbers. I can call Menards or a store and state we found this through a UPC code, and they can tell me that, yes, we got six in a few months ago, two are sold, but two are on the shelf, so two are missing, but they cannot provide me with a serial number. So it's a real retail problem. So back to the answer to that question, same pawn shop in a 2.5-month period, brand new. He knows, you have to know better if you're in the business.
I would think. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my follow-on question to that is, especially in situations where it's very obvious, you're dealing with the same person taking in all this these things and sometimes at the same time, do you attempt to pursue criminal charges for receipt of stolen property, have you tried to do that, and have you been able to do that successfully?
Well, Sergeant Simmons.
Thank you. Yes, there's a numerous answers to that question. Of course you attempt to pursue criminal charges, but the main problem is what I just stated. A lot of this stuff doesn't come back stolen because the store has never reported it stolen with the proper serial number. But that said, do you as a police officer not investigate this person? And what you do find out 95% of the time when you do a criminal history is they have a long criminal history. They are a shoplifter. They're a booster. But it's tough to prove, in some cases, the property needs to be, we need a victim.
Senator Olson, were you talking about, do they try to prosecute the store, shop?
Right, Madam Chair, that's what I'm talking about.
When you find something like that, Sergeant Simmons.
The city and county attorneys, no. Back to what the chief said, and I agree with them, that the statute concerning theft, the statute reads that you have to knowingly, you have stolen property. So we would have to prove, even though to me it seems obvious that this employee knowingly accepted stolen property from that person. Very tough to prove. My city and county attorneys don't at this point seem to want to touch that at that point. So if you're asking, have we pursued criminal charges against pawn shop employees for buying this stuff? No, for those reasons. It's just tough to prove they knew this stuff was stolen. The customer, that they knew they were buying stolen property from a customer.
You know, I have a question actually for Senator Betzold. I'm thinking about this and the secondhand goods dealer. I'm trusting that the amendment, Senator Betzold, leaves out places like Salvation Army or Goodwill stores and that kind of thing. Those would be the 501c3 organizations, I would guess. Am I correct about that? So, well, can you tell me maybe if it would then apply, a secondhand goods dealer, I think, is new to this subject matter, right, to this area?
Madam Chair, if you look at the bill as introduced, it defines a secondhand goods dealer, a person engaged in business selling, receiving personal property, excluding motor vehicles previously owned, rented. The A1 amendment specifically excludes 501c3 organizations.
Right, and that was my question. Right. So I just wanted to be sure those are the kinds of places. But then something like Second Wind, you know, whether you take used exercise equipment or I suppose, what about, I don't know, about a dress consignment store or a place like Half Price Books?
Mm-hmm. Madam
Chair. Would they be covered by this?
Well, again, Madam Chair, if you look in Bill, third page, starting line 23, it says, the state or municipality may require pawn brokers and secondhand goods dealers to collect consumer data, provided that it be disclosed. So nothing in this bill mandates that any data be required. If a municipality, for example, desires to include secondhand stores in addition to pawn shops, they would have that opportunity under this bill, which they currently do not have.
Okay. So I... All right, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, and I usually agree with you on most of the legislation you've brought forward, but I'm concerned especially about, not just for the reasons I said but I have a question on Subdivision 2 that talks about consumer data and the need for probable cause.
On page 3, Senator
on
Olson,
page
it looks
three.
Like, line 20.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Would that preclude law enforcement from discovering those kind of patterns that it finds from randomly looking at this data, as we've just heard described, so that if you have 75, if you're looking for 75 of the same thing having been pawned by the same individual, but you don't know that without going through and looking that data, so you don't have any probable cause to go on that kind of search, Wouldn't you lose the ability to discover that kind of criminal activity?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Betzold
and Senator Olson. First of all, let me make a comment or two. You know, when I was running for re-election in 2006, I saw a lot of literature opposed to me, and by the time I was done, I wasn't going to vote for me because it was just so nasty. And you know, and just what I've been hearing about this bill, you're thinking, geez, why would anybody do this? If I were trying to eliminate APS. Out of a bill that would eliminate APS. This doesn't eliminate APS. All the testimony you heard would have you believe that's what it does. I think we should read the bill. The bill, now, I've got questions about the collection and use of the data. It doesn't eliminate their collection of data. They still collect the data. It just requires a reason to access the data. Now, I'm told, for instance, that law enforcement, they've got unfettered access to driver's license data, but they have to have a reason to go into the database. They can't just sit there and surf if they feel like it. And if the pawn shops are going to be required to collect data, why not have a reason to go into the database? If they could, now, I use the term probable cause in the drafting of this bill because I was looking for something that they would be familiar with. I'm told that there's already in place certain standards and so forth for law enforcement to access other existing databases that would be easily adopted towards this bill. I don't have that language here. It would be more appropriate before the judiciary, but there are systems to do that. And as I say, you know, the database is still going to be there. I think that rather than making pawn shops an arm of law enforcement, they have to collect all this data. We would never stand for this if we collected any kind of this data at Target stores and turned it over to law enforcement. I'm just saying they can still collect the data. Law enforcement can still have access. Just have a reason why you're doing it, not just because we're all collecting it and turning it over to you. Senator Olson, I would like to just briefly comment on, you know, your daughter's situation. I'm appalled
that they, that your daughter was given that kind of a response. When you've got the system, they're collecting the data, law enforcement already has it, it's public data, and they tell her that she's got to go do her own work when all they have to do is go on their own computers and look it up, I'm appalled that you, they would, she would give them that kind of response.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, in defense of law enforcement, they did do that type of search, but she was also told that in terms of going, you know, that as I think has been said here, a lot of that sometimes isn't correctly coded or for whatever reason. I don't really know the details, but I know they did do a search, and I know that they were said that they would be watching the system for this, these objects, but they didn't, they had just had a wedding. A lot of the things were wedding presents. They didn't have the serial numbers to be able to give them, and so just looking at that search wasn't the same thing as going from shop to shop and looking for the information.
And again, Madam Chair, Senator, we've heard that relatively few transactions. You've heard the testimony of page 3 of the Fridley report. Says the report claims that less than 0.03% of all items pawned are confiscated by police. This is an accurate statement. So the odds that it showed up at a pawn shop are pretty remote.
Members, Senator Gerloff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a fascinating day. This is one of those bills where we're asked to referee something that a lot of us don't know much about. And so we're struggling with and wrestling with that. But I have a question here. I have several. One is about the secondhand stores. It sounds like that's an emerging issue, that is a, as more jewelry or electronics or higher priced items are finding their way into these secondhand stores, that is becoming a separate conduit from pawn stores or pawn brokers, and it sounds like it's an emerging issue. That's why they want to include these in the bill. It spreads out the base of those who are paying the fees and such, and that may be a fine thing. But a lot of these secondhand stores, these consignment stores, the dollar value on stuff, I mean, yeah, there are certainly examples of where they have expensive stuff, but there is a lot of very low-dollar stuff in these CD stores. I mean, any individual CD is, you know, what is that, a couple of bucks? Furniture. You look at that. So we're going to, if you have, there's a furniture store, a consignment store in my district owned by two women. And I think they the name of it is some combination of their names, and they just, it's consignment. And the stuff in there is not real expensive. And it's, you know, it'd be a coffee table for $25. Well, they, under this, under the bill, I think they'd have to do up the whole dossier, go into this database and be in all of that and that. So I guess I have a problem with that piece. There ought to be a dollar threshold value. Or there ought to be a, if it's untraceable, if there's no serial number on it, then how do you trace it anyway? How do you trace a CD that comes in somewhere? I mean, why even bother? I mean, why shouldn't we have a dollar threshold on that, so that we aren't sucking in all of these, we were really complicating simple transactions. That's one thing.
Can I address that, please?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Sergeant,
thank you very much. In the city of St. Paul, there is a secondhand ordinance, and we basically eliminate things like that for a couple of reasons. One, like you say, CDs, you can basically, unless somebody engraved their initials, you cannot identify them.
So you handle that.
Furthermore, with furniture and things like that, we do put dollar amounts on them. But the main reason we keep it out of the picture or try to limit it is because, in general, when burglaries and thefts occur, they don't steal dresses and tables. In general now, windows have been stolen. I mean, things have happened. But in general, the number of items stolen is not what we're talking about. So we don't care that we don't need that report from these people. So we've had a secondhand ordinance in place for, I think, 2.5 years in the city of St. Paul. Went to council. People came in and had their say. And it's worked just fine. We have criminal cases out of it. There is a $2.50 fee. It's a manual fee at this point. Next week, the city of Minneapolis has a system that may be able to put out the secondhand stores, because I know during all my investigations with the pawn shops, they would always point me, what about that secondhand store and what are they doing? So we have a legitimate one. I'm not sure what the senator's proposal states, everything, but it's working in the city of St. Paul, and Minneapolis has a similar secondhand ordinance at this point. Okay. So, sir, we don't, like you say, state the stuff that you can't identify or just isn't frequently stolen. We don't propose that they identify that and report that to the police.
Senator Grillo.
Well, it's not, thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like Senator Betzold's bill is permissive in the sense that it allows for that regulation. I don't understand how the city of St. Paul can have an ordinance covering secondhand stores if it's not allowed in statute. Maybe I'm confused on that. Maybe Senator Betzold knows
that. Well, Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, again, this is only relating to the database. If they want to expand it to
I see what you're saying. That's why it's manual. Okay,
sure.
I get that. I get that.
Because right now, frankly, there is no statutory authorization in this APS system. It's something that's created by ordinance by the city of Minneapolis. They've expanded it, and as far as I know, the legislature has never really delved into this issue, which is why I'm bringing it forward. And Senator Gerlach, on your point, yeah, I think it's a legitimate issue to say that maybe there should be a dollar amount you should look at before the fee is charged. Whether that logic applies to pawn shops, I think, is also a legitimate question. Because, I'm not here basically to, as a spokesman for the pawn shops, my interest was the data issue. But it just seems to me that if you're going to have effective law enforcement tools but have it reasonable, why not have it affect not just pawn shops but other possible outlets of what might be stolen goods? And if you're going to have a threshold, why not have it apply to equally across the board? I don't get what some of the opposition is, because I think this strengthens their hand.
Okay.
Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, another question. I was told that private entities can subscribe to the system. I don't know that I caught that in any of the testimony, but I was kind of shocked by that. I was told Abbott Northwestern, UPS, University of St. Thomas, among three, I was told, are subscribers to the system. So in theory then, I guess, or in practice, somebody who has a password or whatever given in these private entities could go on and look up people's driver's license numbers or that long list of things. And I mean, is this true? Because this is something that I think is a strong piece of your bill that I think is wrong if that's allowed under the practices. Could you fill me in on this, see if I understand that correctly?
Senator Betzel.
Chair, Senator Gerlach, partially correct. Anybody can subscribe to the property side of it because it's public data. And you can go down to the police department today. Anybody can subscribe to the database with the transactions. The personal data that's collected, the driver's licenses, the name, the height, the race, all this other stuff, that is classified as private data. That is not subject to people who anybody wants to subscribe to it. However, as part of the database, law enforcement has unfettered access to both sides of it. If you went down to your police department today, they could give you the list of transactions. If you want them, they would not be able to give you the private information, but they have it.
Nice. Okay.
I'm just curious. That raises a question in my mind. Just a moment, Senator Olson, if you would. Just why those institutions then would just want to know the items that are being taken in. I mean, is it because they're looking for something to buy, or they're looking for things that may have been stolen from them, or what? Cassidy.
Madam Chair, my understanding of why a private entity would subscribe, like Abbott Northwestern, because the stolen items from their hospital, such as TV sets out of hospital rooms. We hear that wheelchairs are a big problem. St. Thomas University might subscribe because they want to follow up on burglaries in their dormitories or from their classrooms. So, but all they can track, though, is the VCR that was stolen or the television, and then they probably would contact, through their security departments, the local police department, local jurisdiction.
Okay, right. Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, I wonder if you would consider in your bill possibly from the secondhand stores excluding clothing and books, because in the area where I live, we have a lot of poor people, and there's a good purpose to be served by encouraging people to recycle clothing and books. I don't think those are two items that are very often stolen, and they're low value items. And I know that these businesses tend to come and go in our community because they have a very the profit margin is difficult for them to maintain, and yet they're really providing a service all the way around. And so it would seem to me that what we're really trying to get at is not having people do the same thing that pawn shops traditionally do, just by calling themselves something else and unfairly competing and avoiding all these rules, but that we have other kinds of goods that we really don't want to discourage that aren't competing with pawn shops.
Senator Betzold.
And of course, if this bill moves to judiciary, you know, we have an opportunity to consider those things, just as we have here. I don't know whether there's other categories beyond those two that should be considered. I think that's a legitimate point, but I'm not the expert in that area. I think people, you know, who have tracked, you know, secondhand goods, and I think every law enforcement can tell us, you know, here's stuff that just isn't likely, that stuff that we need to track, but maybe they do. I don't know. I don't know. If somebody comes and pawns a, you know, Gutenberg Bible, that might be of interest to somebody. So,
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there are a lot of unintended consequences in this bill, Senator Betzold, and I just really don't want to have to do any work on a bad bill. I'm not with Senator Olson. Let's take this out and let's add this. I don't want to do any work on this not-ready piece of legislation. So that's my feeling on it. I don't think we should pass it out.
Well, Senator Betzold, would you take offense that I share with you my perception that the committee thinks the bill needs more work? Even, you know, I don't know that it should be done here, though, at the committee table. And that, but we do have this committee does have an interest in the other businesses that would be impacted. And I think they need to be able to talk to us, unless, you know, you think you can resolve that with a dollar amount or whatever. But it seems to me they ought to be aware that they're being brought in, and ask you to come back to us. Is that
2 years
ago? I think.
Yeah, obviously it's a prerogative of the chair. Let me just point
out. Yeah, I think that's
probably
right.
The bill was introduced late last session. For the specific purpose, it would be out there over the interim and people contact me. And I've had a lot of people, law enforcement, contact me wondering why I was getting rid of APS, which, again, I said, well, that's not what the bill says. The fee issue was a huge one. I think it is about the money in many instances here. But to be honest with you, I didn't really have anybody contacting me about the secondhand store. And, again, not everybody can track everything that's introduced, but at some point, you know, word did travel about this, but I wasn't contacted about people who had interest in that one. But this doesn't mean there isn't an impact. It just means I didn't hear anything.
No. And Senator Betzold, I mean, I'm a co-author on the bill, and it didn't hit me what that meant until we were sitting here having the conversation about the bill. So, I mean, that's a concern of mine. And, I mean, I also want the police to be able to continue to have access to the information. Obviously, that's included. Do other members share my concern here? I don't. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, yeah, as I was listening to the testimony from all of the groups today, I kind of broke it down into four areas. And is this bill about consumer privacy? Is it about local control? Is it about solving crime or raising revenue? And all those things are kind of hitting me at once, and I want a bill that maybe does many of those things, but depending on which side you hear from, I'm a little bit confused as how I might vote on it at this point. So I appreciate maybe some more. I'm not sure if we can clarify that in the next 10 minutes or so.
No, and we have just, 12 minutes, if I can see the clock here with the lights flashing, shining in it. We need to be out of here at 2:30. Senator Betzold, I think I'd like to see the bill come back, but I think you've heard the concerns of the committee and certainly of the folks in law enforcement and in local government. So if you want to do that, maybe.
Over, we'll continue talking and see if we can work on some amendments that might do exactly what I suggested. You know, keep the APS system going. You know, just have some reasonable controls on the access. I mean, if it's unfettered access, well, you know, I don't think I'll go there. But that's this committee's choice. You know, as to what you want to do. But you know, I think that there's ways that you can, you know, clean up some of the other areas of the bill that you know, I mean, might at least give them additional comfort for committee members.
Okay. Well, with that, we will lay the bill over. And obviously, Senator Betzold, you and I will converse about, you know, when we might do this again.
Sure.
Thank you for, and thank you to everybody who came here today. I think that you saw that it works to have to come here and spend the time and the energy. And I think, you know, maybe we can make things work better so that Senator Betzold can get some of this done. Members, I have a reminder that we will meet on Thursday, but we won't meet until 1:30. Okay? And at that time, we are planning, we think that we will be hearing the I-35W Survivors Compensation Bill. There's a feature in there having to do with subrogation, and I want all of you to study up on subrogation between now and Thursday. That has to do with the insurance company coming back to a person who's received an award and being reimbursed then for what they have spent to cover the insured expenses.
Couldn't we bring in someone to train us in a pizza?
Quiet on this one.
We haven't adjourned yet. Excuse me.
I'm thinking a pizza in the chair's office meeting with someone to
That sounds like a good idea. Committee, just hold on a second here. Okay, so please, it's going to be important, and we're going to have, an hour and 15 minutes on Thursday to do that bill, and that'll be Senator Latz's bill. And so next week we're going to be hearing some mortgage foreclosure and predatory lending bills. Actually, I think most of them are mine. And we'll hear Senator Pretner Solon's aviation liability and hope that Senator Olson's wireless bill will be before us as well next week. I don't know if you knew that, Senator Olson, but we may add some bills. This is for next week.
Right. Okay. I heard you say that, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, any other business? With that, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you, members.
Wireless thing that